This is The Blade and Beyond with the DC Dynamic Duo. Learn every detail about life on both ends of the knife. And now, live from Washington, D.C., your hosts, board-certified facial plastic surgeon, Dr. Michael Somanik, and board-certified plastic surgeon, Dr. Troy Pittman.
Here we are, everybody. It is Sunday, April 10th. This is episode 19 of The Blade and Beyond. I'm Dr. Troy Pittman.
And I am Dr. Michael Somanik. Happy Sunday, everyone.
I'm a little tired today.
Why?
Because we stayed out past 11 o'clock.
I know, we're old.
So last night was our holiday party, our 2021 holiday party that we needed to cancel because of COVID, and we finally had it. And so those were our big festivities last night.
I know, it was a holiday party 4 months later. And it was great. I mean, Easter's right around the corner, so people were confused on our post on Instagram that we were having a holiday Easter party. Had nothing to do with Easter. We actually kept our food menu logo with the original Christmas lights on it.
And I wore my holiday outfit. Yeah,
you did. So it was a great time to celebrate our entire team. Their spouses, significant others all came. So we had a great group in a private room at one of our favorite restaurants in DC, RPM Italian.
Yeah, the staff really deserves it. They work so hard and they all do such a great job. I had made some comments last night. And when you look at the trajectory of our practice over the last 4 years, we started out at 1,700 square feet. And now with the med spa expansion, we are going to be at 10,500 square feet.
It's a lot. And that I really, always say that.
That really is the success of our staff who work so hard and they are committed to the brand. And we really couldn't do it without them.
Yes, they work tirelessly on a daily basis, always with a good attitude, always with the team's best interests in mind. And that's really what you look for when you are looking to build the team that we have. So I do feel extremely fortunate because we hear from our colleagues across the country. We see it ourselves in terms of customer service that's provided when we go places. And quite frankly, there's a lot of crappy customer service out there of people who don't really love their job. So our job is to make people love their job.
It takes a lot of energy to maintain a very high standard. And I think that, they are providing concierge care every single day and they never waver. They're so consistent with everything they do. So
that's
thank
what makes
you.
A strong team.
If anybody out there is listening from the team, which you all should be.
You all should be. Sunday evening should be love your podcast. All right, what are we talking about?
So first segment today is about DVTs and preventing DVTs in surgical patients. And so one of the things that we are always concerned about when we are doing surgery is patients getting blood clots in their legs.
It's a big deal.
Because that can lead to not only a problem from the blood clot in the leg, but that can also cause a pulmonary embolism, and that can be fatal.
Which is an even bigger deal.
And so we are very serious about screening patients for history of blood clots. Now, just because you've had a blood clot in the past, it doesn't mean that you're not a surgical candidate. But those are things that we need to know about. Family history of blood clots, clotting disorders. And then we really risk stratify patients for DVTs. And we use something called the Caprini scale. And what the Caprini scale does is it risk stratifies patients and gives you a score of what their DVT risk is going to be so we can take the appropriate steps to prevent that.
Right.
And obviously, as you get older or the surgery gets longer, the incidence of DVT goes up.
Why, though? You have to explain that.
Sure. So as we get older, the blood becomes a little bit more viscous. Our ability to move blood through the vessels can be impeded, whether that's from vascular disease or things like that. So, you can be a totally healthy 70-year-old and still be at an increased risk.
Yeah, your veins get kind of old, just like you do. And so the flow sometimes is not the greatest. And stasis or slowing down of the blood is one of the main risk factors for developing a clot within the vein.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think people think of, and it's kind of an urban legend, is that a long surgery increases your risk of developing a blood clot because you're still for a long period of time. And that's actually not true. There are so many things that we're doing in surgery that cause inflammation, right? So if we're doing 6 hours of surgery, that's obviously we're doing a lot to the body. And that inflammatory reaction can cause the blood to become thicker. The anesthesia, some of the anesthesia medications, the anesthesia gases, those can actually make you hypercoagulable. And so having a longer surgery where we're doing more procedures, that can increase the risk of DVT.
Yes, which is why upon induction or with the anesthesiologist giving the anesthesia through the IV, we always make sure that we have the SCDs or the sequential compression devices.
Yeah, they're like little squeezy boots.
We always tell them it's a spa treatment because it basically massages your calves throughout the entire duration of the treatment. So we always make sure those are on before the patient goes to sleep to ensure that we have maximum sort of movement of the muscles down there and the veins.
And inflammation begets inflammation. So patients who have inflammatory bowel disease, who have
autoimmune diseases,
not, although inflammatory bowel disease is an autoimmune disease, not all autoimmune diseases increase your risk of developing a DVT.
So that's a good point.
Yeah.
There's many people out there that are probably like, I have an autoimmune disease.
No, it's not going to increase risk. It's not going to increase your risk. Obesity, though, BMI over 25 increases your risk. We don't really like for patients to be taking oral contraceptives or hormone replacement therapy because estrogen and progesterone can actually increase your blood viscosity. So women on birth control pills just walking down the street are at a little bit of an increased risk of developing a DVT. But certainly for my patients, even though they're going to be mobile right after surgery, I really like for them to stop their oral contraceptive about a week before surgery and stay off of it for about a week after, as long as they're ambulating normally. We alter that more for patients who are having tummy tucks. Tummy tuck, and I'll talk about that in a second, is a high-risk surgery for DVTs. If you've had family members who have had DVTs, you can be at an increased risk. There are certain genetic diseases which causes your blood to clot abnormally. So there's something called factor V Leiden deficiency, which is an activated protein CNS. So those are two autoimmune, genetic conditions that can cause you to be hypercoagulable.
And a lot of the times when women, it's mostly women that find out about this because they end up having miscarriages, unexplained miscarriages.
Right.
And so they end up getting worked up by a geneticist and diagnosed with this. But just because they're diagnosed with it and they've had, had miscarriages, doesn't mean that they necessarily have had a blood clot of significance. You know what I'm saying?
Well, one of the things that...
it's something for us to be alerted for.
That is one of the reasons why someone will get a hematologic workup off the bat. And they may have, you know, it's a little bit of a complicated story that we don't have time to go into. But there are some people who have one gene for a genetic predisposition to blood clots, and it's not harmful to them. They actually need to have both genes because they're recessive traits. So they need to have both genes in order to be hypercoagulable. But the bottom line really is we have a sheet that all of our surgical patients, we fill out at the preparation, at their pre-op, and it gives them the score. And so that gives us the guidance of whether we're going to just use the squeezy boots on their legs, or are we going to treat them with Lovenox, low molecular weight heparin, after surgery for a certain number of days to keep them from getting blood clots. I do not like for my patients to fly directly after
How
surgery.
Long?
So for minor procedures like breast augmentation, a surgery that is considered kind of a quicker surgery, I don't like for patients to fly for 3 weeks. And there are a number of reasons for that. I don't like them flying because It's hard to fly on an airplane without someone bumping into you. And after you've had your breast done, you don't want someone bumping into you. They have to put their bags in the overhead.
Yes, lifting that luggage is a big thing.
So I asked them if they're going to be traveling within the first 3 or 4 weeks, they need to have a companion. But the biggest thing that I think a lot of people don't know is that when you are in a plane at a high altitude, you become very vasodilated. And right. So it can cause blood pressure changes. It can cause abnormal bleeding. Mm-hmm. It drives me a little bit crazy, though, in the on the international flights, they have little DVT exercises in the little magazine. And it's about pumping your feet and moving your ankles around. And really, DVTs, most of the time, they start in the iliac vessels, which are actually in the hips.
Right.
And so in a seated position. So I don't really like my tummy tuck patients to really be flying for 6 weeks, because a DVT and a tummy tuck patient, they're already sleeping at night in kind of a V position to take tension off of the incision. And so the blood can pool in the iliacs. But on an airplane, the blood is obviously pooling in your hips and your iliac vessels. And what you really need to do on an airplane, this is like a little PSA for all of you going on international flights, you really need to stand up and move around.
Yes, get up and walk around.
Yeah, because that altitude is going to cause you to vasodilate. It's going to cause your blood to pool. It actually causes your blood pressure to go up a little bit. Just the change in barometric pressure makes your blood pressure go up a little bit. And then alcohol obviously dehydrates you. So you're looking at a situation where you're vasodilated, blood is pooling.
What thins your blood a little bit?
You're dehydrated. And so your blood is thicker because you're dehydrated. Mm. So those are all reasons that you could get a DVT on an airplane.
I've never seen those exercises.
They're in the the American Airlines magazine.
That's why. I never touched that gross magazine.
Yeah, I think that they don't even have them on the planes anymore. But they have the little exercises. But you should get up every couple of hours on a flight and just walk up and down the aisle to get that blood moving.
Yes. So I think the big question that people may be listening saying, I'm going to be having surgery in the future or whatnot. If I do have surgery, what can I do to prevent a blood clot?
Well, we have the boots that we put on the patients.
So stuff they can do, though. Is there anything
early ambulation after surgery? Certainly.
Preoperatively, specifically.
No, preoperatively, it's all about risk stratification. So obviously, there are things that we can control, which is a healthy weight, stopping medications that could cause you to get a DVT, like birth control pills, hormone replacement therapy. But there isn't really, if you have a genetic predisposition for a blood clot, there's not anything you can do. I have said no to patients who have had pulmonary emboli in the past.
Right.
And
with high risk surgery.
They're just so high risk that it's just not worth doing elective surgery on them. It's not safe. So most of it is risk stratifying to figure out who's a good candidate and who's not a good candidate. But then postoperatively, unless we're putting them on an anticoagulant or a blood thinner because they are a little bit higher risk, moving around. I think that if you have surgery, if you have a facelift and you're getting up and going to the bathroom and then you're relaxing on the sofa in between, going to the bathroom is moving the blood through your legs pretty much enough to prevent you from getting a blood clot. We have patients that wear compression socks to their surgery sometimes.
I love it.
That keeps blood from pooling in the lower extremities as well.
I wear compression socks whenever I operate, and I got you started on it too.
Yeah, it's great.
It really, it gives you more energy at the end of the day. For anyone that has a job where you are on your feet most of the day, try really good compression socks. And what I mean by that is like, they measure it in millimeters of mercury. You'll see it on all compression socks, like
which is
20 to 25 millimeters of mercury. That is probably like the standard for the amount of compression. Try them and you'll find that at the end of the day, you actually have more energy because your vascular system, your venous system is working much more efficiently.
Well, your blood pools in your legs. So if you're standing up all day long, your blood volume is in your legs. And if you can get it out of your legs with compression stockings, you just have a more efficient circulatory system.
Yeah,
it's night and day as far as being tired at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't feel that exhaustion at the end of the day. So that's about DVT. Anybody have other questions about DVTs, DM me on Insta.
All right. Well, that was very comprehensive. I feel like I reviewed the DBT assessments. And now we're going to go to one of my favorite segments, which is...
In the news.
All right. We have a few things in the news this week. One is Piper, one of our dogs. She got her very first inaugural trim. And the reason why only one of them, for people who are like, why ignore Sophie? Sophie has a little bit of alopecia. And for those of you that listened to our segment last week, we're very sensitive to the subject.
We're not doing PRP injections.
But we are not doing PRP injections on her. We're just loving her as she is. But she really doesn't have a lot of hair to trim. So she did not go to the groomer. Piper, on the other hand, inherited the beast hairy gene and has tons of hair. And it's probably more of the terrier on her. So we had a little bit of a process going into the grooming thing. But we did that and dropped her off at the groomer yesterday. I felt like a parent dropping off a one-year-old. I was anxiety ridden, thinking about it the whole time after I dropped her off. And they called me an hour and a half later and we picked her up. So what are your thoughts on her?
I don't like it. I don't like her haircut. I think she looks like Judi Dench. It looks like a crew cut.
It's a little bit crew cut.
This little wild beast look, which I love, and I think it's part of her personality. And I wish they would have left her facial beard a little bit longer and the hair on the top of her head a little bit longer, because now she literally looks like she has a crew cut.
Well,
she's ready for
listen,
basic training.
It's almost summer. She gets really warm in the summer with that long hair. So I think she's going to be much happier. She actually told me that she kind of liked it yesterday. So
hasn't seen herself in a mirror.
I think we're on the same page, but we're going to let it grow in over the summer.
And we're going to keep her away from mirrors.
And maybe get a different groomer in the future, because this one was a little bit different. Okay. We talked about Will Smith on our last podcast leading up to our alopecia thing. And there's been some new revelations with the Academy. They've now announced they're going to suspend him from the Oscars.
For 10 years.
For 10 years.
Who cares?
Now, do you think that that is a strong enough punishment for him?
Well, you know, what's funny is in the press release, they said that they suspended him from attending in person or virtually.
Oh,
so
wow.
I guess they're not going to send him the link to virtually watch.
He's not going to be able to zoom in.
Well, which is so crazy is, how do you virtually attend the Academy Awards? Isn't that just watching it on TV?
Well, I guess if he has to accept an award virtually, I don't know. But, you know, I can tell you he's not going to be nominated for a very long time, if not ever. I truly think they should have taken the Oscar from him.
Yeah, I agree with you.
They should have taken a strong stand against just violence in general to say, like, this is not allowed. I mean, it all starts from the fact that they didn't even remove him. So, but anyway, I think the Academy needs to take it one step further. That's all I'm going to say about it. More to come in future podcasts, hopefully with...
Why are we talking about this? Was this Sophie's alopecia?
No, I wanted to bring it up because we talked about it last week or on our last podcast, and I thought that was a really nice continuity. I'm channeling my inner Robin Quivers today, talking about various aspects of news, not just plastic surgery news.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. Is that all you have?
That is not all I have.
Oh, you have this.
I have two more stories. We're going to actually
story about the goat?
No. Stop. Spoiler alert. I'm going to talk about Sharon Osbourne. She actually showed her new face a couple days ago.
She has a new face.
Well, she was in bed posting a picture, and she looks like she had some additional plastic surgery. So as usual, with someone in the spotlight, there's some haters. You're beautiful as you are, blah, blah, blah. But you know what? She has been maintaining herself for years and years and years. And who knows how many facelifts she's had. I think she looks pretty damn good, though.
Okay.
And this is a testament to someone that wants to maintain their look and keep looking. I think she looks pretty natural, actually.
Yeah.
And good. The problem is that, you know, she's had issues with weight her whole life. So sometimes she may be a little, have gained weight, and her face looks plumper. So we don't really know if it's filler, if it's fat, injected fat,
and then
whatever.
She loses weight and she gets saggy skin.
But either way, more power to you, Sharon. I think that you're looking amazing. Keep up the maintenance, and that's
and
all.
And she has to deal with Ozzy Osbourne, which probably is an aging factor as well.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to deal with, I can imagine. And their relationship, I don't even want to get into that.
I always like the way she looks.
Yeah, me too. And I love her red hair. The last segment, or the last thing in the news, is The Secret to Eternal Youth. One of my friends sent this to me, asking me last week, is this true? And basically the headline was, and this was in the Daily Mail, that scientists developed a new technique for rejuvenating skin cells. And they basically took skin cells, did something genetically to them, and were able to alter and reverse the way those cells behave by about 30 years. So like the cells or the tissues that have fibroblasts or the collagen producing cells, they measured the quantity of that. And they were able to show that they were kind of able to convert some of these cells into higher producing fibroblasts, et cetera, where they were more functional, basically, as like a 30-year-old versus a 60-year-old cell.
Okay.
Are you confused by this? You're making weird faces.
No, I'm just thinking about the aging process and about telomeres, which are the little things that get shorter as we get older, right?
Yes.
Or do they get longer?
No, I think they get shorter.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So is this...
Oh boy, I don't know.
I don't know.
Somebody's got to fact check us. Anyway. Yeah. But the issue with this is that sounds great, right? But, and you're like, just inject me with this genetic whatever.
Well, that's modifier. Why I was making a weird face is, do you put these things on your face?
No. I think this is, it's in a petri dish at this point, but it would be injected. The problem is that this like anti-aging thing can also stimulate cancer cells. So, similar to making these other cells hyperfunctional, it doesn't really discriminate. So that's one of the issues with it. And that's one of the issues with some of the exosomes that we study, which are the most like purified form of growth factors, basically, that injecting exosomes into the bloodstream is very controversial. There are some people that do it. I would not recommend it. You don't know what these growth factors are stimulating systemically. Right. And they may hit a cancer cell that says, hey, I love this growth factor. And then it starts growing. So anyway, interesting.
Our bodies are making cancer cells every day. And our circulating immune system is killing those cells. Those tumor suppressor cells are killing the cells before they become a malignancy. So yeah, there's probably there's a little bit of a risk in just turning the on switch on all of your cells, because you are going to have uncontrolled growth.
Right, exactly. So I thought it was interesting, obviously, that this is something very preliminary. But it goes to show you that worldwide, there is an incredible amount of research going into anti-aging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we are entering a realm that there's some really cool stuff coming with that. It's probably, who knows, 10, 20 years away from even coming to some type of fruition with this, but we'll see.
Okay,
that concludes our segment for In the News, we're gonna close with our last segment, which is, I was trying to think of how to phrase it basically, but it's talking about facelift through the decades is how I think it is best put, meaning there are certain ages that are... Where am I going with this?
Well, let me pose a question.
Yes, thank you, because I'm stumped.
Because you're going...
Well, because I'm
just
still thinking about the cells.
You're just thinking about the cells. You're kind of rambling. So let me help focus you.
Okay, fine.
So patient comes in who's 35 years old. She's lost weight. She has sagging in her face. She's got little jowls. And she says to you, I'm only 35 years old. I know I'm too young for a facelift. What are my options?
Right. So thank you for recentering me, because I wanted to review, basically, there are many different types of people that are candidates for facelifts.
Of all ages.
So many patients will come in and say, oh, I just turned 51. I think I'm still too young for a facelift. Not true. But that person may not yet be a candidate for a facelift, depending on what their expectations are. To your point of someone that's mid to late 30s, maybe has no jawline, some submental fat, a little bit of skin laxity, I probably would say you're not a facelift candidate, because I could probably do submental liposuction with non-surgical skin tightening and give you a decent result and save the facelift for later.
But younger people who've lost weight...
weight loss, we're talking... 150 pounds, etc.
Don't you feel like most patients who come in who want a facelift, what they really are asking for is better jaw definition.
Yes.
And sometimes you just cannot give better jaw definition without lifting the skin.
Yeah, I've had to do a neck lift on someone that was 38 years old on several occasions, not just one person. And that's because in order to get that jawline contoured, I had to address some of the skin laxity. And sometimes that's just genetics. Some people are just more predisposed to losing collagen, losing elastin at a younger age. And if they can pull their skin and stretch it, like that one picture of, we've all seen it on like Shutterstock and stuff, of that woman stretching her skin. If you can stretch your skin like that, it's usually a pretty good indication that you do probably have a less skin, overall skin tone, compared to someone that may have better genetics or may have better collagen density to their skin. Now, conversely, someone who's in their 50s and 60s has aged, has lost collagen and elastin, really independent of genetics sometimes.
And they have more wrinkles.
Yeah, and they have more wrinkles because of dynamic lines, maybe cumulative sun damage, all of those things. So they are kind of a candidate for a more comprehensive facelift, we'll call it. Now, you're probably wondering, there's so many different approaches I read on this. There's the smash lift, there's the deep plane, there's the modified deep plane, there's a short scar. All of these things are really trying to achieve the same thing, which is elevating the tissues, addressing the skin laxity, contouring the jawline.
And volumizing the midface.
So there are so many social media accounts now, and just like in the news, talking about deep plane facelift. Now, I will say a deep plane facelift is appropriate for certain individuals. A 38-year-old person that probably hasn't sustained much descent of their soft tissues, but has a little bit of skin laxity in one's definition, doesn't necessarily need a deep plane facelift.
Well, they don't have a, because they don't have a deformity of the deep plane.
And the deep plane, what that means is we basically make an incision underneath the skin. So once we've elevated the skin on the cheek, we make an incision sort of obliquely oriented from the corner of the jawline towards the corner of the eye. And you lift up that SMAS layer. It stands for superficial musculoapronautic system. And in lifting that layer, you are freeing up some of the ligaments to the musculature, to some other bony cutaneous ligaments. And you're basically freeing all of that up so it can mobilize that tissue and restore the position of the fat and the volume to a more anatomically youthful position. But like I said, not everyone needs that. Mm-hmm. And it's a great approach. There's a reason why many people are talking about it, because it does produce really nice results. But particularly if someone just needs to contour their jawline but doesn't have a lot of mid-face descent, I don't do a deep plane on them. And they get a great result. We've shown in studies, and there are some more research to go into this, and some people that do deep plane would disagree with me, but studies have shown that there's really not a huge difference in the overall longevity of your result with this SMAS facelift, or not skin only, SMAS, which is lifting up the SMAS layer, or deep plane. Between those two, there's not a huge amount of a difference when you look at like 10-year data.
Well, I think the biggest thing is there is kind of this misconception. We have patients, potential patients, who call the office all the time and they'll say, does Dr. Somanek do a deep plane facelift? Does Dr. Somanek do the S lift or a short scar lift? And I don't think any surgeon who has experience, they don't always do just one thing. The appropriate thing is to do the right operation for what the patient needs. You know, patients call all the time, just to bring it back to the breast, I'm going to steal your, I'm going to hijack your segment,
look at
just
you.
Like you do to mine. So patients call, they say, does Dr. Pittman do a lollipop breast lift or does he do the anchor? And the answer is, it depends on the patient. And so we're trying to find the right operation for what is bothering the patient and what their anatomy is, right?
Yes. I'm going to tell you what drives me crazy. And Ariel, my coordinator, was talking to me last week about a couple patients she had talked to or spoken to, and specifically about deep plane. And the woman said, I've looked at a lot of before and afters, and I like the before and afters with deep plane. So I think I need a deep plane. And the before and after is a result of the surgical procedure.
Right.
Not necessarily
how it was done,
the technique with it. Mm-hmm. And so I bring it back to, this has to be a very individualized approach. This is why the consultation is important, why I need to see you in person, and why I'm pinching your skin, moving tissues around, as uncomfortable as that may be sometimes, where, you know, people, the last thing they want is me pinching their platysmal bands. But I want to see how much laxity they have. Is there a fatty component to that area? And I want to see how mobile their midface is. If it's very mobile, you know, they may not need a full deep plane. Not everyone needs the exact same cookie cutter procedure specifically with facelift.
And this goes back to the thing that we've addressed so many times on our podcast is not obsessing over before and after pictures that you aren't see on the you. Internet.
They're not you.
Spend your time researching the credentials of your surgeon and not obsessing over before and afters of people who don't look like you or people who you don't know what their circumstances were.
And even in the office, we have like a PowerPoint that we have on the iPad that we can show you different patients that I've operated on for a given procedure to show you a variety of results. But even with that, it's a variety of results. My technique is not exactly the same for each one of those patients.
Exactly.
But I can tell you that I have consistency with the results. And that's the most important thing. Uh-huh. Don't get so caught up on, tell me exactly what you're going to be doing there in the surgery. Because really, does it matter to you? And would you understand it anyway? I think what the most important thing is understanding that your surgeon can deliver a consistent result amongst all his patient demographics. And that's what I strive to deliver as well as you.
So the top 3 points here is, number one, facelifts aren't just for old patients.
100%.
They can be for younger, middle-aged patients as well.
That's right. Depends on a variety of factors that we talked about. Fat, skin laxity, overall facial anatomy.
Talk to your surgeon about your health conditions to help risk stratify you for a DVT.
Yes, you absolutely want to risk stratify yourself. Do not hide your health history. This comes up so often that a patient kind of fills out their paperwork kind of lackadaisically, and because they're like, doesn't really matter. And we'll get their history and physical from their primary care. And there's like 5 other medications, a piece of their history that they just didn't tell us about. So we look at all of that stuff going in because we want to make sure we're as maximally informed as possible.
Well, elective aesthetic surgery is still surgery. It's not a haircut.
That's right.
Okay, well, that's good.
I've got to cool off. I got to eat it.
Yeah, you're really just all over the place today.
Am I red?
No, you're not red, but you're really
I got really worked up over that. Sorry, guys.
I'm very passionate about this. I'm wound down because I was up too late last night. Okay, we're going to get some rest. Everybody have a great week. We will be back next Sunday.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening.
That's a wrap. Remember to share the podcast with your friends. Follow the docs on Instagram at SominicMD, at Dr. Troy Pittman, and at DC Dynamic Duo. To learn more about the procedures discussed on today's podcast, visit www.SominicPittmanMD.com. That's www.SominicPittmanMD.com.